Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Well, in the second hour of today's show, I'm going to continue with some of the stories we were covering there. And at the top of the list, there was the Australian carbon price. Now, of course, Australia has had a carbon tax which went into effect in 2012. And this has been extremely controversial in our country. The mass of people really do not agree with it. Polls have shown that opposition to it is well above 50%. The government lied in order to get the tax through. And of course, part of the plan for this is that it would actually transition to what they call a carbon trading scheme, which is similar to what they have in Europe. But we saw there in the coverage of the plunging carbon price in Europe that the European regulators say they're just going to intervene and they're just going to force the price back up. So they're even undermining the concept that it actually would be a free market mechanism. So in so many ways, the carbon tax is illustrative of what I see as the undermining of the principles of a free market and a free society. Now, I'll just continue here playing a clip from ABC's World Today, where they're talking about the European carbon price and its possible effect on the Australian situation. And they had an interview there with Greg Combe, the climate change minister.
And just on this topic, we are linked to the European market. I believe that the system gets hooked up in 2015. So what does it mean for us?
Well, yeah. as I said, we'll examine all of that in the context of preparing the budget.
The climate change minister, Greg Combe, was more explicit about what the plunge means for Australia.
Well, in the budget in coming weeks, there'll be a revised forecast for the carbon price in financial year 2015-16 and a revised revenue forecast as a result. A lot of the expenditure related to the carbon price is related to the actual that's issued in free permits, and so therefore the expenditure reduces if the price reduces as well. Other expenditures, are provided in cash.
It's a problem for the government. The revision down follows its abandoned surplus promise for the year and its struggling minerals resource rent tax, which is also failing to meet Treasury forecasts. Again, Greg Combe.
Yes, well, once the Australian Emissions Trading Scheme from the 1st of July 2015 links with the European market, that means we'll have a common carbon price with 31 other countries. And so obviously the price in the European market has an influence on the Australian price at that time. But that's 2 years away and a lot of things can happen between now and then.
There's a looming budget black hole.
The opposition's climate action spokesman, Greg Hunt.
The government should indicate what it will cost the budget, but it is potentially billions of dollars each year. So we have a carbon tax, which is the worst of all possible worlds. It's not decreasing emissions, but it is driving up the cost of electricity at precisely the time that the European carbon tax is collapsing.
Okay, now I'm just going to read to you from another article here on specifically the European carbon price. European carbon price slumps after EU vote. The price of carbon in Europe has plunged after the European Parliament rejected an emergency plan that would have forced companies to pay more for polluting. It's interesting they always throw in that word polluting there to make it sound like we're really doing something good here. In fact, they're just talking about forcing them to pay for emitting carbon dioxide, a colourless, tasteless gas, which is actually plant food. Continuing with the article, European carbon permits fell as much as 45% to as little as 2.63 euros a ton. And the slump resonates here, given that Australia has a fixed carbon price of $23 a ton until moving to a floating market price linked to the European scheme in 2015. So basically what's going to happen here, ladies and gentlemen, is that with the European carbon price collapsing, a massive amount of money that the government was expecting to reap in terms of carbon taxes, which would then become carbon permits, is going to be gone. It's just not going to be there. I mean, it is going to be a disaster for the economy, a disaster for the budget, yet another nail in the coffin of the whole carbon anthropogenic warming fiasco. It really is falling apart. It's just falling apart in so many different ways. The unprecedented slump, as it says here, the unprecedented slump has raised a debate about whether emissions trading schemes are the best way to handle climate change or to make carbon polluters pay. The problem for the EU scheme is that the Eurozone debt crisis and slowing economic growth has meant less industrial output. That means less pollution, and as a result, companies have been buying fewer carbon permits, and the price has dived from highs of as much as 31 euros a tonne in early 2006. Now, that is pure editorialising there. I don't think that's the reason for it at all. I mean, there has certainly been a bit of a slump in the economy, but that doesn't... doesn't make any sense, ladies and gentlemen. Because the purported purpose of the carbon trading scheme is to reduce fossil fuel emissions, right? So the permits are related to the relative usage of what they call clean energies or alternative energies to so-called polluting forms of energy, which produce carbon dioxide. Now, if the price of permits has dropped in the way it has, that would indicate that there is certainly less demand for these permits. But does that mean that there is actually an increase in clean energy? No, there is not. There is something wrong here, because that should be the way the mechanism works. It shouldn't be that simply a slump in the economy generally causes the price of the permits to drop. Again, I'm not an expert in these matters, but then neither are the writers and journalists from the ABC. At the very least, it's clear that this development highlights that there is no movement, there is no motivation to be buying carbon permits. I think the free market, in a sense, may be self-correcting and saying, well, here's something that we really just don't need at all. And so the price will naturally drop to zero if it's something that nobody really wants. Now, just reading again from the article, today's proposal, and this is from the EU, to reduce the short-term supply of carbon permits as a way of pushing up the price came from France, but was rejected by the EU Parliament. So, isn't it interesting? They're actually saying that they would like to reduce the supply of permits and that will then push up the price. I mean, look, honestly, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. The whole thing seems irrational. And think about what it is that we're actually talking about buying here. These are permits to pollute. We're trading them like stamps or like, you know, like bonds. We're trading them as some sort of commodity. And yet it's really hard to actually see how that commodity has a value. It doesn't really have a value. It's a pure construction. It's a pure artificial construction of the government corporatocracy. It's not a real commodity. And I think that really does undermine the nature of a free market in essence. But, you know, whichever way you look at it, I think, again, this situation illustrates the fact that carbon pricing, whether you call it a free market mechanism or a carbon tax, it is not wanted, ladies and gentlemen. The business community does not want it. The average person does not want it. Anyone who's looked into climate science and done a little bit of personal research knows it's rubbish. Even people who believe in anthropogenic global warming, many of them don't think it's a good idea, because it is an artificial way of trying to address a problem which will only benefit those players who've positioned themselves well in this market. It is so open to exploitation and scams, and there have been so many scams exposed in this system. It is just so wrong in so many different ways. And I do believe that the collapse of the carbon price in Europe is a final indicator that even where it seemed to be most entrenched, that it has now lost its popularity. And I do believe that within a few more years, we'll start to see the phase out of this entire discussion. Of course, those who have been responsible for perpetrating lies and fraud will duck and weave and will try to avoid any kind of personal implications, any kind of personal price to pay for having participated in these various scams. And what we'll tend to see is the media will just sort of move on with some other kind of environmental gambits, and it will just sort of morph into another discussion. It'll still be along the same lines, but it won't be strictly along the carbon and reducing carbon emissions direction that it currently is. At least that's my prediction. We'll see whether that actually happens. I do believe we are running towards the end of the carbon myths, though. And while we're on the subject of climate change, I've got a new article here from joannenova.com.au. Jo Nova, of course, a very prominent Australian climate skeptic and someone who's done incredible work to bring the discussion back to science, to really stick with the most important scientific arguments, to continually challenge the powers that be with their irrational, woolly thinking, their complete furphies that they put into the media. And one such is claims about Antarctica losing its ice. We've heard a lot of talk about that over the years. We've seen news reports saying that Antarctica is losing its ice. It's a terrible thing. We see these video footage of great ice walls cleaving off the ice cliffs in Antarctica, and we sit there watching TV and we think, my goodness, isn't it terrible? You know, the Antarctica, this wonderful, pristine wilderness, and because of climate change, because of us, it's all being ruined. And we see those images of the ice cleaving off, and we think, oh God, you know, it's just so terrible. Well, Joanne has uncovered some research here that Antarctica is actually gaining in ice mass. And this is research that I've actually found as well a number of times when I've looked into it. Just reading here from Joanne's article. It is difficult to say anything for sure about Antarctica because the weather is so variable. Bumper snow one year and not so much the next. But 800 years of ice cores spread across Antarctica shows the surface mass balance is more likely to have been increasing over the last century. And a quote here. A paper published today in the Cryosphere finds Antarctica has been gaining surface ice and snow accumulation for the past 150 plus years, and finds acceleration in some areas, noting a clear increase in accumulation of more than 10%. In the coastal regions and over the highest part of the East Antarctic Divide since the 1960s. Very important point there, since the 1960s, an increase in 10%. You're with Truth News Radio, don't go away. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. They say everything can be replaced. And every distance is not near. So I remember everything. Every man. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. I've been talking here about climate change and the Antarctic ice coverage. And it turns out that, contrary to what you may have heard on your favourite mainstream whore media outlet, that in fact the Antarctica is not losing ice. It has in fact gained more than 10% since the 1960s. And reading here from joannenova.com.au, she makes the points here. Over 800 years, Antarctic ice changes all the time, but current rates of change are not unusual. And this is all taken from studies of ice cores. The surface mass balance changes over most of Antarctica are statistically negligible, and the current is not exceptionally high compared to the last 800 years. The times with the highest accumulation, the 1370s and the 1600s, match records of solar radiation. Since 1960, the ice and snow accumulation has increased by 10% in coastal regions and over the highest part of the East Antarctic Divide. An interesting observation here made about solar irradiance. 800 years of stacked records mimic the solar irradiance. The link between those two variables is probably indirect and linked to a teleconnection in atmospheric circulation that forces complex feedback between the tropical Pacific and Antarctica via the generation and propagation of large-scale atmospheric wave train. Maybe indirect, but it is still connected. And it's a very, very important point, because the connection between solar irradiance and global warming generally is one which the skeptics have been pushing for a very, very long time. Now, it goes on to say here in the article, as far as we can tell, the Antarctic ice sheet is growing. The surface mass balance appears to be growing at 200 gigatons a year, with a large amount of variability. Climate models predict that snow and ice ought to accumulate over Antarctica and that this will help slow down a sea level rise. Maybe the models are right on this, but there's no evidence in this data that the current accumulation is different to natural cycles. The summer melt might be faster at the moment, but the accumulation rate is also seemingly at the higher end. If climate scientists want to blame increased CO2 emissions in the last 150 years for the increased ice mass and faster summer melt, then how do they explain all the other rises and falls over the last 800 years? Look at the graph and ponder that all the bumps and falls were natural, apparently, but that last bump were due 90% to coal power stations. Now, that may be a little confusing for the listener. I'll just try and explicate what she's actually saying there. The authorities, it appears, have tried to claim that this accumulation of snow and ice is actually caused by warming temperature. The argument being that with higher temperatures, there is more precipitation. More precipitation means more snowfall. Therefore, more accumulation of ice. Of course, it's a completely paradoxical argument, because it's, again, completely against what we've heard on the news, that Antarctica is losing its ice. But again, what we find with so many of these arguments about climate change is they use paradoxical arguments. We have to refer to George Orwell to understand why that might be the case. It's a way of messing with your head, folks. 2 + 2 = 5. You know, I mean, it's a logical contradiction. But when it's told to you over and over again, you lose the ability to think. You lose the ability to use your own mental process. I mean, this is my interpretation of it. You may say I'm reading too much into it. You may say I'm being too conspiratorial here. But what I'm trying to do is actually just give you my gut feeling about how this information is being presented. Anyway, there's a graph here that shows snow accumulations. And as she's saying, there's various bumps in the graph over time, over the past 700 or 800 years. And we can see bumps and troughs. And at the moment, we're in a bump. But of course, there was a big bump in 1600, and there was a bump in 1400. But in this case, we're being told that the bump is actually due to anthropogenic global warming. Now, I mean, I'm not here to say that that increased temperature will not be a cause for increased snowfall. That may, in fact, be the case. But it's the duplicitous arguments that are used by the proponents of the anthropogenic climate change agenda that duck and weave between various positions. So on the one hand, they're saying, oh, Antarctica's losing ice, therefore it's global warming. Then they're saying, oh, Antarctica's gaining ice, therefore it's global warming. It's like, oh, you know, there's droughts. That's global warming. Oh, there's floods and rain. Oh, that's global warming. Oh, any extreme weather is global warming. In fact, there is no data that is not global warming. Anytime you get a piece of data that proves global warming, it's duplicitous, it's illogical, it's deceitful, it's corrupt, it's wrong, and just has to be exposed as such. Okay, just moving along, I'd like to talk a little bit about Bitcoin. There has been an incredible surge in the price of Bitcoin on global markets, and some people have predicted that Bitcoin is going to crash. I've got an interesting article here from Business Insider, how Bitcoin is changing the world. And a comparison is made here between Bitcoin and the music service Napster, which was developed in 1999, which became quite huge and then suddenly collapsed, mainly actually due to being shut down and bankrupted by government intervention. But there is some interesting parallels there, and we indeed may see Bitcoin interfered with because there has been a lot of concern with the big banks that that is kind of stepping into their territory, and they don't like that, you know, and they'd certainly love to collaborate with governments in shutting Bitcoin down. Now, just reading here from the article, lawsuits led in July 2001 to Napster being shut down, but the idea lives on in the form of BitTorrent and other peer-to-peer file sharers. The story of Napster helps to explain the excitement about Bitcoin, a digital currency that is based on similar technology. In January, a unit of Bitcoin cost around $15. Bitcoins can be broken down to 8 decimal places for small transactions. By the time The Economist went to press on April the 11th, it had settled at 179, taking the value of all Bitcoins in circulation to $2 billion. Bitcoin has become one of the world's hottest investments, a bubble inflated by social media, loose capital in search of the newest thing, and perhaps even by bank depositors unnerved by recent events in Cyprus. Just like Napster, Bitcoin may crash, but leave a lasting legacy. Indeed, the currency experienced a sharp correction on April the 10th, at one point losing close to half of its value before recovering sharply. Yet the price is the least interesting thing about Bitcoin, says Tony Gallippi, founder of BitPay, a firm that processes Bitcoin payments. More important is the currency's ability to make e-commerce much easier than it is today. And we'll continue with that after the break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. My name's Terry Wood-Fenton. It's great to be talking to you today. We'll be right back.
But what's we
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. And I'm just running through an article here about Bitcoin. And we've seen indications that Bitcoin may be headed to a collapse, but it may also change the way we think about money henceforth. And that is the substance of this article. So I'm just going to continue here reading from the article. Bitcoin is not the only digital currency, nor the only successful one. Gamers on Second Life, a virtual world, play with Linden dollars. Customers of Tencent, a Chinese internet giant, deal in QQ coins, and Facebook sells credits. What makes Bitcoin different is that unlike other online and offline currencies, it is neither created nor administered by a single authority, such as a central bank. Instead, monetary policy is determined by clever algorithms. New bitcoins have to be mined, meaning users can acquire them by having their computers compete to solve complex mathematical problems. The winners get the virtual cash. The coins themselves are simply strings of numbers. They are thus a completely decentralized currency, a sort of digital gold. I think it's really interesting to note here that central banks are completely removed from the equation here. So this, in one sense, explains why there would be a lot of intent there to try and eliminate Bitcoin. But then, even if they do eliminate Bitcoin, there are other contenders that will possibly take its place, and I'll get to those in a moment. Just continuing here from the article. Bitcoin's inventor, Satoshi Nakamoto, is a hacker who created it in 2009 and disappeared from the internet sometime in 2010. The currency's early adopters have tended to be tech-loving libertarians and gold bugs, determined to break free of government control. The most infamous place where Bitcoin is used is Silk Road, a marketplace hidden in an anonymized part of the web called Tor. Users order goods, typically illegal drugs, and pay with bitcoins. Some legal businesses have started to accept bitcoins. Among them are Reddit, a social media site, and WordPress, which provides web hosting and software for bloggers. The appeal for merchants is strong. Firms such as BitPay offer spot price conversion into dollars. Fees are typically far less than those charged by credit card companies or banks, particularly from orders from abroad. And Bitcoin transactions cannot be reversed, so frauds cannot leave retailers out of pocket. Yet for Bitcoins to go mainstream, much has to happen, says Fred Ersham, co-developer of Coinbase, a Californian Bitcoin exchange and wallet service. Getting hold of Bitcoins for the first time is difficult and using them is fiddly. But the real threat is competition. Bitcoin proponents like to point out that unlike fiat money, new bitcoins cannot be created at whim. That is true, but a new digital currency can be. Alternatives are already in development. One such is Ripple. It will be easier to use than Bitcoin, says Chris Larson, an entrepreneur from Silicon Valley and co-founder of OpenCoin, the startup behind Ripple. Transactions are approved in a few seconds compared with 10 minutes in a typical Bitcoin transaction. There is no mystery about the origins of Ripple, nor any association with criminal or other dubious activities. OpenCoin is expected to start handing out Ripples to the public in May. It has created 100 billion, a number it promises never to increase. To give the new currency momentum, OpenCoin plans eventually to give away 75% of the supply. Anyone opening an OpenCoin account will receive 5 Ripples. Existing Bitcoin users will get more. On April 10th, several blue-chip venture capital firms announced that they had invested in OpenCoin. If Ripple gains traction, even bigger financial players may enter the fray. A firm such as Visa could create its own cheap international instant payment system. And what if a country were to issue algorithmic money? At that point, Bitcoin would probably be bust, But if that happened, its creators would have achieved something like Mr. Sean Fanning, who created Napster. Napster and other file-sharing services have forced the music industry to embrace online services. Bitcoin's price may collapse, its users may suddenly switch to another currency, but the chances are that some form of digital money will make a long-lasting impression on the financial landscape. We'll just leave it there, but I think that article will give you something interesting to mull over and an interesting prediction for the future. With many people losing their confidence in the monetary system and with the banks behaving as they are, despicably, inevitably there is going to be a change. And I think possibly digital currencies could be the money of the future. So keep your eye on it. I think it's very important. I probably wouldn't be investing in Bitcoin myself at the present time. But some of these other new currencies that are popping up might be worth taking a look at. Anyway, I'd like to just move on now with another story. I'd like to move to something a little bit more edifying. We often talk about things here that are somewhat get you down. I just want to play a clip here from a British philosopher by the name of Alan Watts, who died in the 1970s. He was a scholar. He wrote books about Zen Buddhism. And this is an interesting little audio clip where he's really just talking about life and decisions and paths in life, and particularly for people who are young, thinking about what it is that they want to do with their lives. And I just thought it was interesting enough to want to share it with you today. Someone sent me this. It's been bouncing around on Facebook. You may have already heard it, but I'll just kick the clip off here, and I will resume when that concludes.
What makes you itch? What sort of a situation would you like? Let's suppose, I do this often in vocational guidance of students. They come to me and say, well, we're getting out of college and we haven't the faintest idea what we want to do. So I always ask the question, what would you like to do if money were no object? How would you really enjoy spending your life? Well, it's so amazing. As a result of our kind of educational system, crowds of students say, well, we'd like to be painters, we'd like to be poets, we'd like to be writers, but as everybody knows, you can't earn any money that way. Or another person says, well, I'd like to live an out-of-doors life and ride horses. I say, do you want to teach in a riding school? Let's go through with it. What do you want to do? When we finally got down to something which the individual says he really wants to do, I will say to him, you do that. And forget the money. Because if you say that getting the money is the most important thing, you will spend your life completely wasting your time. You'll be doing things you don't like doing in order to go on living, that is, to go on doing things you don't like doing, which is stupid. Better to have a short life that is full of what you like doing than a long life spent in a miserable way. And after all, if you do really like what you're doing, it doesn't matter what it is, you can eventually turn it, you could eventually become a master of it. The only way to become a master of something is to be really with it. And then you'll be able to get a good fee for whatever it is. So don't worry too much. Somebody's interested in everything. And anything you can be interested in, you'll find others. But it's absolutely stupid to spend your time doing things you don't like in order to go on spending things you don't like and doing things you don't like, and to teach your children to follow in the same track. See, what we're doing is we're bringing up children and educating them to live the same sort of lives we're living, in order that they may justify themselves and find satisfaction in life by bringing up their children, to bring up their children to do the same thing, so it's all wretch and no vomit. It never gets there. And so, therefore, it's so important to consider this question. What do I desire?
Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Just returning now to some Australian news. On the vaccination front, another topic we are continually engaging with on this show, the rights of parents to decide for themselves and for their children whether or not to take a vaccine. Well, it turns out that the Greens have now spoken out on the side of the government, on the side of the establishment, on the side of Big Pharma, against those who choose not to vaccinate. It's quite a surprise, even for me. I mean, I've known for a long time how sold out the Greens are with their idiotic endorsement of carbon taxes. And yet, I know a lot of Greens are aware about personal health and alternative health. And I know, and I'm quite sure, that many people who are in the Greens are not big proponents of vaccines. However, as we see with many political movements, the rank and file and the leaders are often on quite different planes. I've got an article here from news.com.au. Educate parents on immunisation, say the Greens. And this is from the 11th of April, 2013. The New South Wales government must stop parents from falling prey to absurd and voodoo claims about vaccination, the Greens say. Interesting they use the term voodoo, because actually I believe that the claims made by governments and big pharmaceutical companies are actually voodoo claims. I believe that vaccine science is essentially voodoo science. It's weird, isn't it, how we see the language doubling back on itself, and we see that the word that should be used against one group is actually turned directly opposite in the wrong way. It's an incredible phenomenon, this twisting of language. Greens MP John Kaye wants the Health Minister to put more effort into a counter-offensive that shows parents the consequences of whooping cough, measles and polio. Only a high rate of immunisation can stop the spread of many diseases, he said. His comments follow a report that found many wealthy parents in New South Wales are rejecting the scientific evidence and electing not to immunise their kids. Notice they say the scientific evidence. It's very similar to the climate change debate, isn't it? There is the scientific evidence, and then there are a bunch of rat bags who just don't get with the program. Mr. Kaye said some of Sydney's most advantaged suburbs were at risk of epidemic, with a potentially deadly outbreak also affecting immunised children. It must be made clear to parents that waiting until a child gets sick is unfair on their own offspring and on others around them, he said. Yes, and of course, it's far better to just inject them with vaccines that haven't even been tested, that have been known to have serious side effects, and for conditions that are just part of normal life, like getting the flu. I mean, doctors are now pushing kids to get the flu vaccine. Previously, it was mainly older people that they said should have the flu vaccine. Now they're telling everyone to have it. They're making pregnant women have the flu vaccine. And, you know, a lot of people are actually not against vaccines. They're just against the inundation of vaccines, the excessive amount. But anyone who now objects, if you make any objection to any vaccine, you are lumped in with the extremist or fringe groups, people who are mentally disturbed, that don't understand science. As he says here, there are too many parents falling prey to absurd and disproven voodoo claims and conspiracy theories. Interesting they get the word conspiracy theory in again. So if you're actually someone who just has a concern about the flu vaccine and you think, well, you know, I just don't want little Johnny to get the flu vaccine this year. I mean, I saw, you know, I knew some people down the road who had some problems with it. You know, there were high fevers and convulsions, and I just don't think little Johnny really should have the flu vaccine. You're a conspiracy theorist. You're one of these people who've fallen victim to voodoo claims. You know, you can't simply say, this is my position, I won't be doing it. No, Everyone must go the same direction. Everyone must think the same. Everyone must act the same. Now, one of the groups that is always in the sights of government and big corporations as they attempt to silence dissent on vaccines is the Australian Vaccination Network, because they have a terrific website and a lot of information up, and they have been educating people around the country about the problems with vaccines. And as they say, they're only interested in helping you make a choice. They're not actually saying vaccines are bad. They're just saying, look, here's information. There are problems with vaccines. You need to know about it. And they're not lying. There are problems with vaccines. Hello, it's real. I've got an article here from March of this year that I'll just read to you. It says, you must take action now. A couple of weeks ago, I wrote to you about the fact that human rights legislation was being considered in Parliament. This legislation could potentially block our basic rights to speak about and make decisions regarding our health. Many of you wrote letters to parliamentarians and even had some responses indicating that the concerns expressed would be seriously considered. Now, on a related matter, an Australian homeopath, Fran Sheffield, is being taken to court by the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission for having the temerity to upload a page on her business website, Homeopathy Plus, referencing studies which indicate that the whooping cough vaccine could be less effective than we've been told. To make matters worse, this page also states that people might want to investigate the homeopathic option for disease prevention. And we've seen other cases where the ACCC has actually targeted Meryl Dorey herself, the leader of the Australian Vaccination Network. Folks, this is becoming quite serious. These people are intent on shutting down dissent. Just continuing here from Meryl's article. Make no mistake, this action by the ACCC could be seen by some as an attempt by a government department to suppress debate on the vaccination issue. It might also be the first step in restricting the practice of homeopathy in Australia. So much hinges on this case. If this case were to be lost in the federal court, the results could be disastrous for all of us. There is the potential for a precedent to be set, whereby the federal government could use a negative decision as a bludgeoning tool to prevent the AVN, health professionals, or anyone else from openly discussing information critical of current vaccination policies. The internet and the media could then be censored further, and people could then be left with no option but to use mainstream medical doctors and drug-based therapies, even if that would not normally be their first choice. So although it may appear on the surface that this court case is only concerned with one practitioner in one particular modality, in actuality, this is an important battlefront in the wider war which we are currently fighting to protect our rights to free speech and informed choice. It is vital, therefore, that we join with Fran and Homeopathy Plus in opposing these efforts to tell us what we can and cannot discuss. If we don't, and the case is lost, an extremely dangerous precedent will be set. And just continuing with the article here. Early last year, Ms. Sheffield was contacted by the ACCC because she had an article on her website which discussed the failure of the whooping cough vaccine to prevent an outbreak of whooping cough that has been raging through highly vaccinated populations worldwide. She also provided information on homeopathic treatment and prevention. The ACCC said that she needed to remove the article or face potential prosecution. At that time, Fran told the ACCC she would remove the article to fact-check it, but if she found it to be correct, it would go back online. Her contact at the ACCC told her they would be watching, and if the same or similar claims were reinstated, legal proceedings could commence. The article was checked, found to be factual, and returned to the website in a slightly revised version. Because of ongoing complaints about a range of articles by people seemingly intent on suppressing information about homeopathy, Fran decided to start a private members-only area of her website for any information that could be considered contentious. Those who were interested would still be able to access the information they wanted, while those upset by homeopathy would no longer be troubled. This section is where the new article was placed. In contravention to the terms and conditions of the Homeopathy Plus website, which they signed and agreed to, the ACCC entered the members area and copied and removed the revised articles and laid charges against Fran, her husband, and Homeopathy Plus. A few important things to note. The information in the article was correct. It was referenced, and it is the same information that can be found in literally hundreds, if not thousands, of other websites. This information was not controversial. It is well known within the scientific community that the whooping cough vaccine is not working well, nor does it protect for long, if any protection is conveyed at all. It is a fact, based on government figures, that we are seeing higher numbers of cases today with our close to 95% vaccination compliance than we did 50 years ago, with very low levels of vaccines. These facts cannot be disputed. They are just not supposed to be told to the public, apparently. And I do hope to get Meryl Dorey on this show. She's been on the show a couple of times before. This is a very important story, ladies and gentlemen. The war against human freedom is stepping up a notch, and we have to step up with it. I'll be back next week. I'll be bringing you a range of stories from around the world. I do hope you can join me. And I do hope to get some important interviews to you over the next month. And one of them will be on the subject of the suppression of vaccine information on Australian websites. I also hope to get Malcolm Roberts, important skeptic and very, very well-versed in the science of climate, back onto the show. That's it for this week. We'll be back next week. Over and out from Truth News Radio Australia.